Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Robots and remote sensing. What ties them together is mathematical algorithms. Dr. Chris McNabb at the University of Calgary is a robot man, and he's using algorithms based on biological systems to help him develop robots that learn. And at the University of Lethbridge, Dr. Derek Peddle and his grad student Casey Vandenberg are using Derek's algorithms to better understand climate change through remote sensing. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. You can already buy little vacuums that scoot around the living room on their own, picking up lint. So imagine having one of those robots that would wash your dishes or clean your clothes. That's how Dr. Chris McNabb views the not-too-distant future. And with the help of an Alberta Ingenuity Establishment grant, this young professor at the University of Calgary is researching how to make robots learn and how to bring the cost down to consumer-friendly levels. I asked Chris what got him interested in robots.
Initially, I was interested in space, and I got into space robots at the University of Toronto. And from there, I've been interested in where you can apply robots other than space. But initially, my interest was things like the arm on the space shuttle, the Canada arm, and because that's really where Canada has been, a leader and a world leader. I was interested in doing something that is actually done in Canada.
What does your research center on?
Well, now I'm looking at how can we make robots learn? So the traditional method of controlling robots is a very formal method of using formal mathematical algorithms and formal logic to try and, instruct a robot exactly what to do. So now I'm looking at more of a postmodern approach where we're interested in a robot that is learning. So maybe when it starts off doing something, it doesn't do it very well. And the idea is over time it would do it again and again and again and eventually get better through learning mechanism.
Well, how do you teach something mechanistic to learn?
Well, the algorithms I'm using are actually based on biological systems. So specifically what I'm looking at is called the cerebellar model arithmetic computer. And it's a computer algorithm that's supposed to mimic what goes on in our cerebellum. And the cerebellum is a part of the brain that's at the top of our spinal cord. And it sends the impulses to our muscles. So it's kind of a very low-level controller in our brain. It doesn't actually do the thinking or figuring out where it wants to go. It's told by the rest of the brain, what it wants the arms and legs to do, and then it figures out what impulses to send to the muscles to get it to do that. And someone a long time ago did a very simple computer algorithm that's supposed to mimic what this does with a computer. So I'm trying to use that and see, well, what can this actually accomplish? What are the limitations of it? But how can we modify it to get even more out of it than has been done in the past?
What progress have you made so far?
Well, other people have been looking at using this for rigid robots. So, well, if you normally think of a robot arm, you would normally think of a rigid robot arm, something that doesn't bend or vibrate or anything. But remember, I was initially interested in something like the arm on the space shuttle, the Canada arm, which actually bends and it flexes and it vibrates, which makes it very difficult to control. But it turns out that almost any robot you built on Earth that would be really big would have these kind of properties. It would just kind of sag under its own weight. But there's also other kinds of robots that have this kind of flexibility in them. And I'm trying to get this computer algorithm to work with robots that have these kind of flexible properties.
What are some of the problems or challenges that have to be overcome at this point?
Well, at this point, I've got things working in theory and on computer simulation somewhat to my satisfaction. I like the way they're going. And basically what I've done is prevent things from going unstable, which is good, because when a robot arm that has flexibility goes unstable, that means that the natural frequency of vibration is being excited. It goes into resonance. And it will, essentially blow up. And that's not a good thing to happen in the real world. So I've gone through the theory and made sure, this is going to do what we want it to do Plus, it's not going to go unstable, which is, you know, the most important criteria. And now I really want to kind of go and test this and experiment and make sure it is going to work in the real world.
How would one of those experiments be set up?
Well, on a very simple level, we can use very, very cheap, simple robots. Even I have some of my students playing with things as simple as Lego robots. And the idea is that these kind of controllers that can learn shouldn't require such an expensive robot as you would buy from a factory that might cost you, you know, $100,000 or more, because it has very, very nice mechanical properties and things behave very nicely so that traditional kinds of control methods can be used. When you're using this kind of control that can learn, it should be able to learn to compensate for any kinds of strange mechanical properties due to really cheap manufacturing processes and things like that. So really, we should be able to buy fairly cheap equipment, maybe even a stick with the Lego or maybe something a little more elaborate than that, and just to see if you know, running these things over and over again, they will learn to control themselves to make up for any kind of strange properties in the system.
Where would these robots be used?
I guess there's two kinds of ideas here. One would be to apply this control to existing robots to make them do even better than what they're doing now. And that's not necessarily a popular idea. You know, you have to sell someone on the idea that the robot isn't doing all it can do, but they might already be satisfied with what it's doing. But the other idea is to build new kinds of robots that don't really exist yet that could do new tasks. They might be small and cheap, or they may be really, really large robots, something that wouldn't be very easy to control. And the idea is that there's all kinds of applications. I mean, you just use your imagination. Well, instead of having a person do this or a person at the controls, why don't we just replace it with a computer that'll do it all for us? So anytime if you passed a construction site, you might say, well, what if all that construction equipment, those cranes and big cement mixers and pourers, what if they weren't operated by people? What if you had computers operating them, you know? And, you know, that's kind of beyond the realm of present technology. And you not only have to do it successfully, you have to make it cost-effective, so it'd be cheaper than how it's done now. And then also having small robots. I mean, everybody wants little robots to run around their house and do the dishes for them and sweep the floor and vacuum the floor. And we're going to be seeing these kind of robots in the near future, actually. There's big marketing plans on for vacuum cleaner robots, for one thing.
Is the idea to use these in areas that are dangerous to humans?
Yeah, well, there's lots of interest in kind of going into hazardous situations. So people have built robots that'll crawl down into a volcano. People have built robots to go into, like, nuclear reactors and be able to do tasks inside where it's very radioactive. Or even outer space can be considered a hazardous environment. It might be a lot easier to send robots to go and crawl around. And we've seen that on Mars, where we've had these Martian rovers. It's a lot cheaper to send them, and they're also, you know, essentially disposable if they blow up. It's not that big a deal, although it costs some money.
You're getting some help with this research from the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. What specifically is that allowing you to do?
Well, specifically, what I've done so far with the support is brought on a few graduate students who are working on these projects. So I said, you know, I want to get this theory and I want to kind of verify it experimentally and have robots that are, people can see and touch and feel that are doing tasks and to actually verify that we can accomplish this in real life. And so that's essentially what they're working on. And, of course, we'll probably have to buy some equipment, too, to verify this. Although, you know, they are working on fairly cheap equipment, but if we have to buy some more equipment to be able to verify these things experimentally, that's what we're going to be doing in the short term. And then after we can verify it experimentally, we can go on to the more interesting theoretical stuff again and see if we can make any more advances that way.
What is the big challenge for you right now?
The big challenge is really to come up with new methods that, you know, not just that nobody's ever thought of before, but something that's kind of inherently simpler. Because the big breakthroughs always seem to be, instead of making something more complex, this researcher has found a simpler way to do it and with some kind of insight into the basic ideas of how things work. And so the idea is, it's really easy to go and say, oh, I'll just make my controller more complicated and hope it works better. But that's not always the case. The real challenge is to say, well, what kind of simpler learning algorithm maybe, or simpler way of looking at things will really result in something that works better. And then that's kind of the big breakthrough. So that's kind of, you know, it's a process of a lot of failure. You have to try out a lot of ideas that don't work before you find one that will work.
Hooray for Lego, eh?
That's right. Well, Lego makes it real easy to build a robot that fails, take it apart, and to start over again. That's a real big bonus.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Chris McNabb, an assistant professor in electrical engineering at the University of Calgary. His research is supported by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. Thanks to the work of geographer Dr. Derek Peddle, the University of Lethbridge is becoming a center of expertise in remote sensing. And when I stopped by Derek's office to find out about his latest project, the first thing he did was hand me some 3D glasses and a blurred-looking picture of mountains. These, I learned, are key to the work he is doing on climate change in partnership with PARC, the Prairie Adaptation Research Collaborative.
Well, this is research we're doing with the University of Regina and the University of Winnipeg, and it's involved with water through the Water Institute here. There's four main topics that we're focusing on: mountain hydrology, forests, agriculture and water, and spatio-temporal analyses based on geographical information science and remote sensing.
When you look at those four different areas, what's involved in them?
Well, they all contribute to helping us understand climate change and how the environment is changing and evolving. In the case of mountain hydrology, the key is we're able to look at really large areas at the same time, and also, and this is using satellite imagery, so we can get an image very detailed over a large area, and then get images from the past and put it together. In the case of mountain hydrology, we're looking at source water inputs to the prairie zone in this case. So we have things to measure precipitation and wind and snow probability, snow accumulation and soil moisture, different indices.
And the other areas?
In terms of forestry, again, we're looking at the influence and the impacts of drought. So things such as productivity and forest fires, the effects of forest fires. Also biophysical parameters and carbon stocks, which is an interesting thing these days, especially with Russia ratifying the Kyoto Protocol recently. Canada has, as we know. So in that case, we can use these archived satellite images from the past to help us determine what the situation was in 1990, the Kyoto baseline year, and then take similar images of, say, now or different years since then, and develop a comparative understanding of how carbon stocks have changed. Because in 1990, no one really knew about Kyoto Protocol, and they weren't taking really those kind of measurements, and certainly not in the form that we now need them. So it's these archive data that are quite important.
What are your other two partners bringing to this?
Well, very different things, and that's one of the strengths of this partnership, is that we're all so different and diverse. The Prairie Adaptation Research Collaborative, based at the University of Regina, the lead scientist there is Dr. David Sochin. He's in the Department of Geography there, and he does paleoclimatology and reconstruction of past climates, and the main tool he uses is dendrochronology, which is tree ring analysis, and in fact, dendroclimatology. So he looks at different tree rings from many years into the past and sees patterns of climate change. So he's really looking at the past, and these are generally from individual points. Now, the University of Winnipeg in Manitoba, the researcher there is Dr. Danny Blair, and he's affiliated with the CFIR, the Center for Forestry Interdisciplinary Research. He is going the other way. Dave Sochin at Regina is looking at the past. Danny Blair in Manitoba is looking at the future. He's simulating and running models of synoptic climatology. So in his case, what would the climate be in with a certain loading of carbon dioxide based on certain decisions and policies we may adopt and adapt to, such as the Kyoto Protocol, or just not doing that, or doing more things in the energy sector, or less things, or whatever. So he's able to do these simulation models. My role is kind of coming at it from yet another angle, because we've developed tools for time series analysis of satellite imagery in other applications. What we're going to do is take those approaches and adapt them to the tree ring data of Dave Sachin and link it to these future predictive models that Danny Blair does in Manitoba. So I'm kind of the bridge, if you will, between the two.
Well, I've got my glasses on now, and you've got this, what right now looks like a very blurred picture of a mountain range. How does this fit into the work that you're doing?
Well, what this is a three-dimensional view of the Rocky Mountains, and then we've applied some computer algorithms to render it in a different way, taking advantage of the fact that we have two eyes, which incidentally are remote sensors, just like the sensors we have on satellites and airplanes are remote sensors. Our eyes and ears are also remote sensing devices. We've modified the image such that when you put these glasses, that I know you're going to take a picture of me with these glasses on, that'll be on the web. When you look through these glasses, it gives you a three-dimensional view. So it's analogous to a stereoscope that is quite common with aerial photography. And it's the same principle of what's called parallax. And it's the basically the slightly different angle that each eye has when it's looking at a surface, or in this case, an image or a photo.
What sort of information does this give you then in relation to, say, water?
Well, this gives us a couple of things. I mean, in terms of water, I guess I should say first that this is sort of a pretty picture kind of thing. We don't put these glasses on every day, though it would be fun to do. Although, you know, these things do help us better visualize and look at the subtleties of the imagery. So they do have an application. It's not just a fun thing. But in terms of water, what we do is we can do three-dimensional numerical modeling of these images and analyze them mathematically and pull out information about hydrology and runoff and so forth in the same or similar way that we look at them with these red and blue glasses, except we can extract quite a bit more with these computer algorithms that we've developed.
Is this something that's done here in Lethbridge?
Well, yeah, there's a company in Lethbridge called Iunctus Geomatics, and this is a company that is relatively new. They've been in business now several years. And they have quite a large contract that they've won in open competition, and they are the international partner with a company in France called Spot Image. And so they're the Canadian channel partner with this company out of Toulouse, France. That company in France has a series of orbiting satellites called SPOT, which is the System pour l'observation of La Terre, which, sorry for my brutal French, but that's what SPOT stands for, System for Observing the Earth. And it's a very well-established satellite system. There's a number of different satellites in orbit. This is one of the longest running programs, in fact. So they have the exclusive rights for all satellite imagery from this sensor in Canada and even in parts of the United States for certain applications. So anyone in Canada who wants to have a satellite image from that sensor has to go through this company, Iunctus Geomatics Corporation in Lethbridge.
How does what Iunctus is doing in this picture fit into the PARC program?
Right. Well, this particular satellite system can look at the surface of the Earth from different angles. So if you picture a satellite going around the Earth in orbit, so one orbit, it's say it's over Lethbridge. And then the next time it comes down, it's a polar orbiting sensor, so it's coming down from the north. The next orbit, maybe it's coming down over Medicine Hat. Now, some of these images, they don't, if there's cloud, we can't get an image. Well, we get an image, but it has cloud in it, so we don't get the surface of the Earth. When we can tell the satellite to look in a different at a different angle, so let's say it was cloudy over Lethbridge, which of course never happens, right? But let's say it is cloudy, and then the next orbit coming down over Medicine Hat, and maybe the clouds have moved off, and we tell the satellite, okay, now just sort of look, 12 degrees west and look over towards Lethbridge, then we can get an image. And so what we get, though, is, and this is where it ties into this thing here, this image we've looked at with the red and blue glasses, it gives us the stereo imagery. So we could have an image from different angles and build up this 3D stereo imagery. And in fact, we can also compute what's called digital elevation models, which is really useful in the water research. And this is one of the things we're doing is we're developing topoclimatic indices in alpine watersheds. And so this imagery is, we're going to be using this imagery from IONCTIS heavily in this project. And we're going to be deriving digital elevation models, getting source hydrology information, as I explained, precipitation, wind, and so forth. And we'll probably put on these red and blue glasses from time to time just to, for the sake of it.
Thank you very much, Derek.
You're most welcome. Anytime.
That was Dr. Derek Peddle, a professor of geography at the University of Lethbridge. He is also the scientific director for WISE, the Water Institute for Semi-Arid Ecosystems. Satellite imagery and remote sensing are the main interests of Casey Vandenberg. So it's not a surprise that Casey would travel to Lethbridge to do his master's thesis under the watchful eye of Dr. Derek Peddle, a leader in remote sensing technology. With the help of an Alberta Ingenuity studentship, Casey is using satellite imagery to develop better carbon budget models.
I'm going to be working with MODIS satellite imagery from the Terra satellite on board the... It's a whole bunch of NASA's crazy stuff. And I'm going to be using this sensor system and these satellite images to try and extract structural and biophysical information of forest environments in mountainous regions. And with this information, the idea is to try and just develop information or just to extract the information that can be used for carbon budget modeling or for just monitoring these resources, sustainable development, sustainable management.
How do you actually do that?
Well, how I actually do this is I'll be using a pseudo-inversion algorithm that Dr. Derek Peddle developed. And what it does is you just input a series of structural information into the canopy reflectance models. And by just matching the outcomes from this algorithm with actual pixel values that you would obtain from the satellite imagery, you can deduce what the actual structural information is. So it incorporates into the model characteristics such as the slope and the aspect of the environment you're working in, the canopy height, the leaf area index of the vegetation itself, as well as just the sun, the solar zenith angle at the time of data acquisition. And there's also a component of spectral mixture analysis. So it looks at information such as the spectral signature of the actual vegetation in the area, as well as the shadowed components that might be influencing the spectral signature. So it kind of ties all of this together into one model, and from that you can figure out what the volume is of the forested environment. You can figure out the canopy height and the biomass of the area.
So are you actually looking at these satellite images through something special, or is it all done on the computer?
It's just software programs that were developed on the computer. There are several different options. There's an NV software package or PCI Geomatic software packages, and these are just all computer programs that were developed for use with the satellite images. So what the satellites themselves do is they just catch an array or just kind of it's like a pixel or a matrix of information of the field of view that it's monitoring. And the software packages is just a platform for monitoring or for working with the imagery, for performing the algorithms and identifying information.
So then you have to deal with NASA. How is that going to go?
I personally will not be dealing with NASA, but NASA did develop the MODIS sensor that I will be using the imagery from, and they've actually created a distribution center for research institutions or basically anyone who wants access to this imagery. So I've been able to benefit from what they've done because I have free access to all this imagery for the research that I'll be doing with Dr. Derek Peddle. And Derek is working in collaboration with a team of research scientists at NASA with working with his multiple forward mode algorithm for monitoring for large-scale mapping of physical structural information.
So the idea here then is to look at carbon sinks or carbon budget?
That's the ultimate goal, because this information is very valuable for climate change and global warming. We aren't necessarily extracting the carbon information. We're just getting estimates of the actual leaf content or the vegetation, the biophysical information that is used to derive all this carbon information.
What got you interested in this aspect?
It kind of stemmed from my undergraduate degree. I was doing a degree in environmental science and physical geography, and I love just the physical side to geography, just the interactions between the environment and things like that. So I took several courses in my undergrad that looked at remote sensing and how it can be used for monitoring of Earth resources, and I just kind of fell in love with it from there. And I knew that I had both the technical background to work with the satellite images to understand why they work and how they work, and I knew that I could hopefully apply this technical background with a more practical aspect that can be used on larger scales.
Now, you're doing this work with the help of Alberta Ingenuity, and you're here on a studentship. How is this going to help you?
It's going to help me tremendously. It will let me just kind of not worry about all the other stuff that many other students have to, and I can focus on what I want to focus on and just do my research, and I don't have a lot of the background just noise just kind of encroaching on what I'm doing, and I can, it's an excellent opportunity. Ideally benefit in the long run the Canadian government on a national basis, and it all helps, and it's definitely benefiting me, so it comes in handy. I don't have to worry about paying my grocery bills and things like that. So,
well, good luck with it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Casey Vandenberg, a master's student at the University of Lethbridge. His research is supported by the Alberta Ingenuity Fund. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.